As Jerry indicated, I want us to look at the example of Melchizedek in the scriptures today. And he really fits into this series, which I've called Bible Snapshots, because he is so briefly presented to us in the scriptures. As a matter of fact, where he's introduced into the biblical narrative in Genesis 14, there are only three verses that are related to him. Jerry used the term obscure. When he used that term a while ago, I thought, why couldn't I have thought of that word? Because that's basically exactly the word that would have been appropriate to use in the way that Melchizedek is presented to us in the scriptures. He's an obscure character, or as I say in my notes, he is a mysterious character. He only appears once, at least in the Genesis narrative, and his name is only mentioned once in the three verses there. Otherwise, you might think he's a rather unremarkable character because so little is said about him in the scriptures. And he might be forgettable to just about anybody, except for the fact that reference is made to him in Psalm 110, a Psalm of David, and verse 4, where it is said that someone would be, the Lord would be made a priest according to the order of Melchizedek. And then, finally, in Hebrews chapters 5, 6, and 7, he is mentioned. And the writer there draws heavily upon Psalm 110, verse 4, and also draws upon the Genesis account of Melchizedek to make some points about him, particularly in the first part of Hebrews, the 7th chapter. Were it not for those later references, Psalm 110, verse 4, and the references in chapters 5 through 7 of Hebrews, we would wonder, why is he even mentioned in Scripture? And that's part of what makes Melchizedek so important for our study. And beyond that, really, this study, and this is one of the points I want you to get out of our study, is that Melchizedek ties the whole Bible together. Because we have these references to him at the beginning of the Bible, or almost the beginning, in the middle of the Bible, Psalm 110, and then finally toward the end of the Bible, in Hebrews chapters 5, 6, and 7. So he pulls the whole Bible together and shows how really the Bible is a whole. It is stitched together by Melchizedek and other characters and events as a whole. We could not account for this. I don't see how we could account for it other than by the belief that the Bible is indeed the inspired Word of God. But I'll have a little bit more to say about that as we proceed. The very brief and strange nature of this account of Melchizedek in Genesis 14 raises unanswered questions, at least questions that are not answered there in Genesis 14. Nevertheless, these give credibility to the extensive use later made of Melchizedek and the narrative of him there in Genesis, later on by the writer of the book of Hebrews. Melchizedek appears out of nowhere in the Bible and then seemingly disappears into oblivion. And we would never hear of him again except for that reference in Psalm 110, verse 4, and then in the book of Hebrews. Since it is such a short passage, just three verses, I will read to you from Genesis 14 about Melchizedek, let's begin with verse 17, because that gives us just a little bit of background. Then after his, that is Abraham's return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer, And the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Sheba, that is, the king's valley. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. Now he was a priest of God Most High. And he blessed him and said, Blessed be Abraham, or rather Abram, of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And he gave him a tenth of all. And that's it. That's all we get about Melchizedek here in the book of Genesis. So Melchizedek enters into the biblical narrative just as Abraham is returning from the defeat of an alliance of Mesopotamian kings who had come down to the Dead Sea region close to where Abraham was in order to do battle with five other kings who had rebelled against Chedorlaomer. In the process, these Mesopotamian kings or their forces overtake the city of Sodom where Lot was living and take Lot and his family and all his possessions. Abraham, or as he is at this time known in Scripture, Abram, gathers his forces and his allies and goes and attacks the forces of these four kings from Mesopotamia and defeats them and is able to retrieve his nephew Lot, Lot's family, and Lot's possessions. And as he is returning then, that is when Melchizedek goes out to greet him. There are several elements in this story that make it clear that Melchizedek is an unusual person, indeed a special person, an important person. We would like to know more about him, but we don't get it here in this narrative. He is the king of Salem, which is a shortened form for Jerusalem. He is designated as a priest of God Most High. He brings out bread and wine to Abraham. He blesses Abraham and praises God. And Melchizedek receives a tenth of the spoils of the battle from Abraham. So what we have here, and this is a fairly important point, what we have here is really a whetting of our appetites for more information about this Melchizedek. We sense that he is someone who is unusually important and someone about whom we ought to know more. But we don't get that information here. So again, all of this raises questions which call for answers. Just who is this Melchizedek? Why is he presented as both king and priest? Two offices which never otherwise are combined in one man until Christ. Now there is a reference in Zechariah 6 to the Jewish high priest Joshua being crowned as if he is both king and priest, but in that case he only serves as a figure of Christ to come. So Melchizedek is the only man who is actually mentioned in the Old Testament as both a king and a priest. Under the arrangements of the Mosaic Law, the kings and the priests came from two different tribes. The kings of Judah were descendants of David, who was a member of the tribe of Judah. But the priests, on the other hand, in the Mosaic or Levitical arrangement, were from the tribe of Levi, an entirely different tribe. So the priests and the kings under the system of the law of Moses never came from the same tribe. So they could not You could not have a king under the Mosaic system who was also a priest, and vice versa. We ask the question also, why does Melchizedek bring out wine and bread to Abraham? It seems odd, doesn't it? Why is Melchizedek treated with such high regard by Abraham, even as Abraham's superior? Now, Abraham was a great man. He had just come from defeating a great coalition of four kings from Mesopotamia. So he was great, and he had just demonstrated his greatness, if not superiority, by defeating these four kings. So why, at this juncture, should he be treating some strange man, king of Jerusalem, though he was? Why should Abraham be treating him with any sort of deference as he does? Why is it that Melchizedek blesses Abraham? Why is it that Abraham gives a tenth of his spoils of battle to Melchizedek? These are the questions that are raised. Now, as I've mentioned, David makes the second reference in the scriptures to Melchizedek, specifically in Psalm 110, verse 4. This is roughly 900 or 1,000 years later. 900 or 1,000 years later. And out of the blue, David takes this otherwise obscure character, Melchizedek, all the way from Genesis, who lived, a character who lived during the time of Abraham, and makes this otherwise strange statement about someone who would be made a priest according to the order of Melchizedek. And this, by the way, is a messianic psalm, Psalm 110, referring to Christ, that is. Because in verse 1, there is a well-known reference to Christ. The Lord said unto my Lord, sit at my right hand, until I make thine enemies a footstool for thy feet. And this passage is quoted in the New Testament. So we know that this is a messianic psalm. Then we have the third and last set of references to Melchizedek in the book of Hebrews. So in about another 1,000 years, we have this writer of the book of Hebrews referring to Melchizedek. Only he fills in the picture for us. He helps us to understand the importance of Melchizedek in God's scheme of things. Indeed, by virtue of the elaborate parallels he draws between Melchizedek and Christ, the writer of Hebrews more fully explains Melchizedek as a figure whose important symbolic value is fulfilled in the person of Jesus Christ. This was Melchizedek's introduction into the biblical narrative in Genesis is all about Jesus Christ. The writer of Hebrews in chapter 7, verse 3, notice, says he was made like the Son of God. That Melchizedek was made like the Son of God. Not just that he was like the Son of God. I think most English versions translate this more correctly when they say made like the Son of God. The point is that he was presented in such a way that he exhibited traits that would later on be fulfilled literally in Jesus Christ. Now, statements are made in Hebrews 3, and as a matter of fact, this is important enough that I will take just a moment to read a few verses from Hebrews, the 7th chapter. Let's look at the first 4 verses of Genesis 7. For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham as he was returning from the slaughter of the kings, and blessed him, to whom also Abraham apportioned a tenth part of all the spoils, was, first of all, by the translation of his name, King of Righteousness, and then also King of Salem, which is King of Peace. Without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, he abides a priest perpetually. Now observe how great this man was, to whom Abraham the patriarch gave a tenth of the choicest spoils. Again, I want to draw your attention back to the fact it says here in Hebrews 7 verse 3 that Melchizedek was made like the Son of God. That is, he is presented with traits that correspond to the traits of Jesus Christ. Only in Jesus Christ they would be these traits literally, while in Melchizedek they were only his traits in the manner in which he is presented to us there in the Genesis 14 narrative. So here's the point. It is not that he was literally, that is, Melchizedek was literally without parentage, that he literally had no mother, no father, that he literally had no beginning, that he literally had no end or death, but rather he is deliberately portrayed as if that were the case, so that he might seem to match these same traits which are literally true of Jesus Christ. A commentator by the name of A.T. Robertson said this, and I think put it rather succinctly and accurately. The likeness is in the picture drawn in Genesis, not in the man himself. And thus, were it not for the information provided in the New Testament, especially by the writer of Hebrews, these questions would remain unanswered, and Melchizedek himself would remain a mystery forever. So let's turn now and look at some parallels between this Melchizedek and Christ. And my wife was sweet enough to remind me to bring out my clipboard this morning so that my papers would not blow away as they have before. Okay, parallels now between Melchizedek and Christ. First of all, there's a parallel in their names, of which there are two I want to bring to your attention, just as the writer of Hebrews does in Hebrews 7, verse 2. First of all, the name Melchizedek itself is a compound name made up of two Hebrew words, Melech, which is the Hebrew word for king, and Tzedek, which is the Hebrew word for righteousness or righteous. So that putting them together into Melchizedek, we find that his name literally means King of Righteousness. King of Righteousness. Everything in the short story about Melchizedek, even though there isn't much there, suggests to us that he is an eminently righteous man. And of course, that matches up with Jesus Christ, who in the scriptures is also referred to as eminently righteous. But also, a second name or reference to Melchizedek is that he is King of Salem. The city of Salem. Salem is from the Hebrew word shalom or shalom, meaning peaceful. As a matter of fact, you might be able to hear some similarity between the two names or two words, shalom and Solomon. Solomon in Hebrew is actually Shlomo. In that form, you can probably hear the similarity more between the Hebrew word for peace, shalom, and Solomon, Shlomo. Because Solomon's reign was a relatively peaceful reign. You can see that in 1 Chronicles 22, verse 9. But in the case of Melchizedek, he was king of peace. That he was the king of peace, or a king of peace, might be indicated by the fact that he did not join in the battle between these two sets of allies, those of the set of allies under Chedorlaomer who came down from Mesopotamia to do battle with their rebellious subjects in the persons of the four kings, or five kings rather, and their armies, their forces in the region of the Dead Sea. So he is, by translation of his name, King of Peace. But of course, peaceableness is another outstanding trait of Christ. He creates peace between us and God by the shedding of his blood. In Isaiah 9, verse 6, he is there called Prince of Peace. Next, let's move on to the offices represented in Melchizedek and Christ. First of all, king. Melchizedek, of course, was the king of the city of Salem. But according to Psalm 2, verse 6, Christ, by prophecy, was also to be installed by God as a king. And when speaking to Pontius Pilate, as recorded in John 18, verse 36, Jesus refers to my kingdom. My kingdom is not of this world, he said. If it were, then my disciples would rise up and fight in my behalf. But as it is, he says, my kingdom is not of this world. It's not a political kingdom. By the way, Jesus there in John 18, verse 36, refers to the fact that his kingdom is a peaceable kingdom, because it is not political or military in nature. But also, to speak of another office, both Melchizedek and Christ are priests. Melchizedek, as I've said, was the only king in the Old Testament who was also a priest. That remained true until the time of Christ. The author of Hebrews especially emphasizes the priesthood of Christ. In Hebrews 3, verse 1, he refers to him as our high priest. Consider then also the origin. Well, Melchizedek is represented as if he had no origin, no beginning. And Christ, of course, had no beginning. As a matter of fact, Melchizedek is presented in the scriptures as this obscure, mysterious figure. He's a king, a great king, but we don't know anything about his background or his genealogy. Now, you might think that's not a big deal, but think about it. When kings are presented in the Old Testament, at least their father is named. And in the cases of some of the kings of Judah, even their mothers are named. This is at a time in a culture when one's genealogy was very important. Genealogy is not so important today. We have people who have gotten interested in searching out their family trees as a kind of hobby. But that is nothing compared with the interest people had in genealogy before. I kind of hate to make this comparison, but it's kind of like, the closest thing I can think of is like your pet's pedigree, if you have a pedigreed pet. Now, I've never owned anything or had any pets other than mutts when it comes to dogs, okay? Just a combination of dog breeds. But some people get pretty interested in their pet's pedigree and may even make purchases of pets based upon their pet's pedigree. Another, not just dogs, but sometimes with racehorses. You always find out, who sired this particular racehorse, who the mother of or the mare was of this particular racehorse. Those things are considered to be very, very important. So that's the closest example I can think of to an example of someone's ancestors or forebears being important. So in an age when pedigree, if you will, genealogy was very important, especially in kings. We don't get any kind of that information out of this great man, Melchizedek. We're not told who his father was. We're not told who his mother was. We're not told from whom he was born, where he came from, when he began, when he was born. Nothing like that. That's the sort of typical information that we get about great men. When you read the biography of great men or women, you will find out where they came from, who their parents were, where they were born. None of that, though, about Melchizedek. That is deliberate on the part of the writer of Genesis. And the writer of Hebrews makes a point from that very lack of information we have about Melchizedek. Without father, without mother, without genealogy, without beginning of days, without end. Now, again, I don't believe that that is literally true. But it is true insofar as that is the way that Melchizedek is presented to us in Genesis. There's that lack of information. But likewise, Christ as God had no beginning. John 1 verse 3 says, nothing that was created apart from him. You know what that means? That means Jesus was not a created being. He had no beginning. He has always existed. Therefore, he is God. Also, eternality. The author of Hebrews, in Hebrews 7 verse 3, portrays Melchizedek as having no end of life. Now again, this is not literally true, but it is true by virtue of the fact that nothing is said about Melchizedek's death. Now, you may think, well, that's no big deal. Well, it is. Just this past Friday, for instance, a news alert came on, the news that I was watching. And it said that Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg had lost her battle with cancer and thus had died. Folks, when important people die, we find out about it. And typically when unimportant people, now you may not consider yourself unimportant, but I'll put myself in that category as far as the world at large is concerned. They make it, their deaths make it into a page or a column in the newspaper called the obituary. And a lot of people are interested in obituaries. They will go to, when they're reading the newspaper, they will go to the obituary section. Oh, I want to find out who died. They want to find out in some cases about people that they never even knew who might have died and won't read about them. When you go to cemeteries, besides a person's name, what is something that you will always see on the headstone? The date of birth and the date of death. That kind of information is consistently important to us. But in the case of Melchizedek, there is no information whatsoever about either his birth or his death. That is, again, deliberate on the part of the author of Genesis, because Melchizedek was intended to foreshadow or prefigure Jesus Christ, who literally had no beginning and had no end. He is indeed eternal. And that is a point that the writer of Hebrews makes emphatically in his comparison of Melchizedek with Christ. That, as Jerry said a while ago, the Levitical priest of the Mosaic system came to an end as far as this earthly life is concerned. Their service ceased. That is not true of Christ. Like Melchizedek, seemingly, he abides or remains a priest perpetually, continually. But also superiority. The author of Hebrews in Hebrews 7 verses 4 through 8 makes a relatively extensive argument for Melchizedek's superiority. He points out, we know that Melchizedek is superior to, even to Abraham, great Abraham. You know how great Abraham was? Just this past week, a peace treaty was signed among the nations of Israel, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates. It was called the Abraham Accord. Why? Because Abraham is recognized as a father, or at least an important figure, in three major religions: Judaism, Islam, and the Gospel of Christ. Abraham was a very, very great man, recognized almost universally as being great. But nevertheless, as great as he was the one who made contributions to or paid tithes, that is, one-tenth of the spoils of battle, to Melchizedek. In this case, it was Melchizedek who was the receiver of the tithes from Abraham. And then he turned and blessed Abraham. And the writer of Hebrews in Hebrews 7 makes the point. We all recognize that it is the greater who blesses the lesser. Abraham was inferior to Melchizedek. Now, when you think about that, you wonder, if that's true, why don't we read more about or know more about this Melchizedek? Why don't we give him more information about him in Genesis 14? Because that would remain until, well, Psalm 110 verse 4 and the New Testament, particularly Hebrews, to tell us what that's all about. And thirdly, of course, Melchizedek was superior because it says he lived on. Nothing is said about his death. It's like he never dies. And as Melchizedek's successor, Christ partakes of the superiority of the head of his order over Abraham and Abraham's descendants, the Levitical priest. Which is to say that the order of Melchizedek is superior to the priestly order of Levi and Aaron. Moving on, King of Jerusalem. As I've said, and according to Psalm 76, verse 2, Salem, and you can see it in the last part of the word Jerusalem, Salem is simply an abbreviation, apparently, of the longer name Jerusalem. So really, Melchizedek was king of Jerusalem. Christ also then reigns in Jerusalem. Not the earthly Jerusalem, but in the New Testament frequently, I say frequently, several times at least, Jerusalem is set forth as the heavenly Jerusalem, that is, the Jerusalem in heaven, which will be the eternal habitation of God's people. Let me finish off this list of parallels between Melchizedek and Christ with a reference to the bread and the wine that Melchizedek brought out to Abraham. Melchizedek did this not only to refresh and fortify Abraham and his battle-weary men, but also to celebrate Abraham's victory and to confirm his spiritual kinship with Abraham. Both of them, that is, were servants of the Most High God. Melchizedek brought out this bread and wine to Abraham, apparently, in the King's Valley. And the King's Valley, according to 2 Samuel 18, verse 18, was apparently just outside Jerusalem. So essentially at Jerusalem. Isn't that interesting? That Melchizedek would have shared bread and wine with Abraham at Jerusalem. I say that is interesting because if you know the New Testament, you're aware of the fact that at this very place, Jesus gave the bread and wine of the Lord's Supper to His disciples as a memorial of the victory His death gives them and as a confirmation of His covenant with them. Finally, the conclusion. You might have been waiting for that especially, right? Okay. Without Christ, let me say, Melchizedek as he is portrayed in the Old Testament would be inexplicable. But the New Testament explains him. Explains Melchizedek's purpose in the Scriptures. He is a forerunner. A foreshadowing of our Savior, Jesus Christ. Melchizedek and the connection the New Testament makes between him and Christ. Then, this takes us full circle to what I was saying at the beginning of the lesson. They make a powerful argument for the unity, that is, the oneness, the wholeness, and the divine inspiration of the Scriptures. Thank you for your patience today.